Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for April 1st, 2021. And a big announcement. First of all, tonight, NASA today released a photo, yes, a photo, of Carl Sagan talking with an alien. It's a verified photo in black and white when Carl Sagan was 12 years old. April Fools. Anyway, sorry about that. I just had to get that in. The rest of the show will be a lot better, I hope. Anyway, a few things going on here. There's a growing list of people launching things in outer space. A growing list. And this is really, really unbelievable. So I'm going to go through the list of the companies that are projected to launch or that already are launching. This is horrendous. I mean, this is obtuse. Okay, just give me a second. I'm pulling. Okay, here we go. And this is a report from the Cell Phone Task Force. At any rate, SpaceX, Elon Musk's project, launched 60 satellites on March 24th. And then OneWeb launched 36 satellites. So these are going up by the dozens at a time. And the report here is that people are getting ill, feeling ill from, is there a one-to-one correlation here? Is there a scientific study that says that a beam of 5G radiation affected this person and that's why they're sick? Anyway, that's hard to do. That's a hard one to do. But anyway, I'm going to go through the list of players here that are launching or expecting to launch satellites. And of course, SpaceX is planning on launching about 30,000 total. Around 1,300 have already been launched. Then OneWeb is another one based in England, the United Kingdom, has launched 148 satellites and will begin providing service after it has 250. And originally it planned on sending up 49,000 satellites and now plans on only 7,000. Can you imagine that? 7,000 satellites. And they want to compete with SpaceX. And then there's Telesat, Canadian-based company, and they plan 1,670 satellites and marketing to businesses. Okay, so let me scroll down here. Now we got AST and Science, U.S.-based company, and this is to have 5G connected directly to cell phones. But it's not going to sell to you, the cell phone user. It will partner with existing cell phone services so that when you travel out of range, for example, from your existing cell service, you can pick up on AST and Science, and they will carry your call. And so they're talking about a 83 million watts per beam. Now, let me tell you, folks, you know, we're talking about 100-watt light bulb here. And now, let me put this into perspective. Back in the, when would this have been? The 1980s, probably, into the 1990s, there was DirecTV. That started, and what happened previous to that is a company called MACOM was selling the original satellite systems. And so what they had is a couple satellites up in geosynchronous orbit. And in your backyard or front yard, as the case may be, or out back if you were on a farm, and this was very popular on farms, you would have a 3-meter dish. That was the standard size. So that's about 10 feet in diameter. So you'd have a pole, a steel pole or a cement pole, with this dish sitting on top of there, and then it had a head-end receiver and then would come inside to a MACOM receiver, which then would translate it into the television. That's why a lot of people got their TV at that time. And I happen to know a little bit about that business. I happen to know a little bit about that business because I sold MACOM equipment. I sold that very equipment. I had a company at the time. And the idea was that when DirecTV came along, the Stanley Hubbard of KSTP, he was the owner of KSTP Radio and Television in St. Paul, Minnesota. I knew Stanley. I was in his office. I knew his son. And great people, just regular Minnesota people, made it very wealthy because of his the business he was in, radio, and then that turned into KSTP Television. It's television, major television channel in the Twin Cities. But his idea was to put the power up in the satellite, and so your dish was relatively small. So he's the first one that did that, and then now you have the DirecTV dish. And that's the brainchild of Stanley Hubbard. So at any rate, now what they're doing, though, is because your cell phone is little and doesn't have much power, or the receiving station might be a chip in your body. You know, when you're getting your vaccine here, the good old vaccine comes along with a chip, and that goes into your body, and it powers off of the heat from your body. So it's a very low power device. So they have to put the power up in the satellite. So this one from AST and Science, they're talking 83 million watts per beam. And so they're now talking about the number of these satellites. Absolutely incredible. And now this is in a beam. So this is not dissipating. This is not 1/r² type of loss. This is a beam of 83 million watts. This is absolutely huge. And you're going to be walking around with this satellite going over, beaming down on you. This gives a new meaning. Instead of beam me up, Scotty, it's beam me down, Scotty. Anyway, just incredible what these people are doing. And I'll get into the FCC in a minute here, criticizing those blokes. Okay, so anyway, OmniSpace is partnering with Lockheed Martin and the U.S. military, and also designing communication with cell phones. It will be able to, what they are saying is that they will enable the Internet of Things on a massive new scale. And so also they're working with military, government contracts, etc., and looking at the international markets as of March 15th, 2021. So that's already gone by. OmniSpace has an experimental license from the FCC and has not revealed how many satellites it plans to operate. So anyway, I'll be talking, as I say, about the FCC in a minute. Okay, next on the list, Amazon, the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos. Anyway. Oh, my goodness, 3,236 satellites approved by the FCC last July. Like SpaceX, it plans to sell small user terminals to its customers for mounting on rooftops and vehicles. And I know people who've already gotten their SpaceX service. Anyway, then there's one called Link, LYNK, Linked OmniSpace and AST and Science. It's similar to those two, is designing its satellites to communicate with cell phones, and it has an experimental license with the FCC. And then Facebook, our good old buddies over at Facebook, wouldn't want to leave them out, and they're going to have thousands of 150-pounders satellites called CubeSats, and also have an experimental license. This, by the way, was giving credit here to the author Arthur Furstenberg, An Invisible Rainbow, A History of Electricity and Life. So I'm going to repeat that so I give credit where credit is due here. Once again, this is information from a book by Arthur Furstenberg, F-I-R-S, just like it sounds, First, E-N-B-E-R-G, F-I-R-S-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, The Invisible Rainbow, A History of Electricity and Life. Okay, so anyway, now I'm going to talk about the FCC. And this is a strange, strange set of bedfellows. Now, the FCC is the Federal Communications Commission. What are they doing approving satellites that are in space? Okay, so they would approve the signal that it's down here on Earth. But what in the world gives them any kind of edict, right, permission, legal authority to give permission for thousands and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands eventually, of satellites in low Earth orbit around Earth beaming down this level of energy? What in the world's going on here? And where's our good friends at the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA? Where are they involved? Because this stuff has got to go up into space. It's got to be, somehow there's got to be some kind of coordination here. In fact, these companies have lawsuits back and forth between them because there's so many of these things up there, there's going to be that they'll be colliding. They'll be bumping into each other. And so they're worried about the first guy there, of course, is Elon Musk, because he had deep pockets and foresight into getting into this business. And so he just went ahead and did it. And plus, he's got his own launch vehicle, something that none of the rest of these have. And so he was able to be, as they say, fustus with the mustest. That's an old expression, military expression. The first with the most, as it is said. And so anyway, but the FCC, what on earth are they doing approving satellites launching and beaming down on you? I mean, you're not the whole purpose of the FCC was to control the airwaves so that there was not a conflict. And here's the deal. Let's just go back to the 1930s, where the proliferation of radios, just regular, AM radios, was the first one, and then FM came along a bit later. But they started having conflicts. And so one radio station would be beaming over another one, so to speak. And so I remember when you were a kid, when I was a kid, that tells you how long ago that was, go out to the friend's farm. And at night, the Nashville radio stations could turn up, the AM stations could turn up the power, so we could listen to the Grand Ole Opry in the middle of the night on just a regular AM radio station. And that would cut in around 10 o'clock, so we'd have to keep it turned down real low so the parents didn't hear us, and we could listen to Johnny Cash and the whole laundry list of country western singers, because they were allowed to turn up to full power. And by the way, speaking of which, this show is brought to you from WWCR, the biggest radio station in the world. And shortwave came as a result of technologies that can beam basically around the world. So I have traveled and listened to my own radio show in many different parts of the world, tuning it in and listening to it on shortwave as I'm actually giving the show and sending the feed to the radio station, etc. So, but that's shortwave. But the FCC was designed to prevent conflicts. And right now, for example, I just cut over from my wintertime frequency to the summertime frequency. What is it, 6115? Because shortwave, certain frequencies work better in the daytime, certain frequencies work better at nighttime. And I'm right in that cusp of 6 o'clock. So when we cut over in springtime, I get a summertime frequency and it changes. And then as we go back in the fall to wintertime, as we cross over that 12-hour day, then the days get shorter and shorter, then I'm 6 o'clock, I'm in the evening time in the dark, and so then I get a different frequency for wintertime. Okay, so anyway, the FCC's job is to control all of that, not to permit satellites, let alone tens of thousands of satellites, into space, beaming down. Beam me down, Scotty. Absolute insanity. Absolute insanity. And it's just one of the many things going on today where this stuff is just being in your face, just stuck in your face and you have nothing to say. And I've said right before, if you look at the companies involved here, if you look at the Facebook and the SpaceX and the Amazon and these other people, these are people with too much money, and all they got to do is get approval from these government agencies that are just revolving door agencies. This is nothing about you out there. There's nothing about the private citizen anymore. It's just completely off the wall, off the charts, crazy. A few weeks ago, I made an announcement, and I'll make it once again. I have a few listeners that are looking for the seed corn that I sold, and that was probably 10 years ago, I think. Anyway, I had this dent corn, seed corn, that I sold. I bought the last pallet. I've told this story before. There was spring flooding. I think it was 2010. It devastated the crops of this particular brand of corn that they were going to three university agriculture departments, Minnesota, Iowa, and I think Wisconsin. And they were growing this for the last season to where they would have built up enough of this where they could where they could market this as seed to start growing non-hybrid corn as a major crop in competition with Monsanto. That spring was a massive flood that wiped out all the crops, and I ended up buying the last pallet of this corn seed from a distributor in Iowa. And I asked him on the phone, I said, I was looking for corn seed to have stored up as a food for myself. And I was looking for organic because one time I went into a feed store. This was up in across the border from Iowa. And I went into a feed store and I said, I want oats, I want corn, and I want, wheat. And the guy at the feed store, he says, what do you want this for? And I'm like, well, it's for myself, for food, for storage, for emergency. He says, you can't eat this. And I'm like, what? What do you mean? This oats, corn, and wheat in a bag, and you're telling me you can't eat this? He says, look, right here it says, not for human consumption. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. What do you mean? You're selling, who's supposed to eat this stuff? They said, well, the animals can eat it. It doesn't kill them, but it'll kill you if you eat it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You mean the animals that produce our milk, that produce our, eggs, that produce, beef on the shelf or hamburger or whatever, if you eat the food they eat, you would die. That's how poisonous this stuff is. So anyway, in my quest, I found this distributor in Iowa that had organic non-hybrid. And so anyway, he told me the story. He said this was the last pallet of this corn seed that these university professors did not plant. There was only one pallet left. And I said, what are you going to do with it? He said, we're going to grind it up for chicken feed. We just got to get it out of here. And I'm like, okay, I'll buy it. I don't know what I'm going to do with this, but I'll buy it. So I bought it. And then I thought, well, yeah, I got a radio show. I'll send this out. I'll package it up. So I did. I sold 250 seeds in a little bag because 250 seeds was the minimum you need for genetic stability to prosper and keep the genetic strain going in the future. And so then I had like 2 pounds in 5 pound bags, something like that. So anyway, I sold this. It went all over the planet, except they wouldn't let it in Australia. They would not let non-GMO corn into Australia. And so there were places where I could not send it. This was rejected, Anyway, a lot of people bought this. The whole pallet went, and it sold it out completely. And so anyway, a year later, 2 years later, people would send me pictures of this amazing corn that they were growing from my seeds. And so anyway, recently somebody wrote in and said, hey, is anybody out there still got this corn seed? Are they growing it? And are they producing seed to the point where we can get some seed? So I said, I will announce it on the air. So if you were one of those people that got that dent corn seed from me 10 years ago and you maintained it, a pure strain, not mixed with something, not cross-pollinated with something else, but pure, let me know. Because not only would they like some, I would like some to get some back. Okay, anyway, there you go. We'll see what happens. See if somebody writes in and says, yeah, I got a whole barn full of it. I got two barns full of it. We'll see. Anyway, a couple weeks ago, March 4th primarily, and then before that and after that, but primarily on March 4th on my show, I talked about the Israelites. I talked about the Israelites, the true Israelites, and a bit of their history. And I did this for a specific reason. There's a lot of this history that I didn't present because it's too complicated. And that was not the point. The point was to remind, and not to remind, because some people never knew in the first place, to remind, to instill in people the true Israelites, who they are. And I'm talking the Irish, Northern Germans, the Scots, and the descendants of the Celts, and the Scandinavian countries is primarily where, and then also England, part of the population of England was of Celtic origin, and the Israelites, etc. So anyway, I'm not going to repeat all of that. And I talked about Joseph of Arimathea and how important it was to understand who he was. He was the minister of mines in Rome. And now in a you know, where you're dealing with the subcontinent, you might call them the sub-European continent peoples that were totally, the Israelites were mixed in there. They were still living in Israel, what is today the country of Israel. But there's a lot of misconceptions that came in, and I got a lot of questions out of this, and I thought, you know, these people really didn't understand what I was saying. And so I'm going to read a couple of these questions that came in from listeners and explain and go through this a bit again. And got an interesting comment that people did not understand the issue that I gave with comets. And this, you can listen to my 2-CD set, the history of Planet X and ancient celestial catastrophes. And so, anyway, I talk about the Venus event. I talk about the Noah's flood being a result of comets. And I also talk in my lectures every Christmas time, I talk about the Christmas star being a comet, which is something they really don't want anybody to understand. So one of the very important things here is to understand the role of comets in these events, that they were major worldwide events. And the Venus event, which was where Moses came out of Egypt with the Israelites, and these were at that point, the 12 houses, the 12 tribes, together following Moses out of Egypt. And there again, these are complicated pieces of history, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail or quibble over details. But then the wanderings of them, and then also a week ago I talked about the people who had lactose tolerance, and that's a very important part of this because the Israelites had lactose tolerance. And so it's a kind of a very interesting way to tell the people who claim that they're Israelites but really are not. I'm not going to get into that on this show. That's a topic for a whole nother show. But anyway, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read some of the questions or comments that people wrote in and then talk about them a little bit to clarify this. So the first one, the person said, this person was a true Irish from Ireland, still living in Ireland, and understands the history of Jeremiah the prophet and the stone that the kings of Europe were all crowned on in Ireland, and the history of that stone coming as part of the Israelites, and the Hebrew, he called them the Hebrew Israelites, which is a good designation. But the comment was, don't confuse me, speaking of me being an Israelite, with the basically the people who call themselves the country of Israel today. And I said, that's the entire point, that the whole history of the Israelites has been absconded with by people that have nothing to do with the Israelites. Their history has absolutely zero to do, but they've taken the name, they've formed a country, and they're not Israelites. And so at any rate, that was the entire point. And so I wanted to clarify that, that when I'm talking about Israelites, don't confuse it with the country of Israel today. That's the entire problem, is that the history, the true history of the Israelites, and the name and the terminology has been absconded with. Okay, so anyway, then here was an interesting one, because I talked about the northern German people. These were the people referred by the Romans as the Gauls. Now, I studied Latin, and when they talked about Gaul, that was northern France. And remember, at that time, there was no division there. But going back thousands of years, the Israelites, some of them stayed in the Mideast. And remember that Christ was descended from the house of David. And that's why they had to go to Bethlehem for the census. That's why Mary had to go there. Joseph of Arimathea was born there. He was probably during the time of Christ's birth was there also. But anyway, they had to, after the Moses fleeing Egypt with the Israelites, they did kind of an end run, and they ended up in the Caucasus. That's where the term Caucasian comes from. And these were the Israelites. This was one of the pieces of history. Then they made their way up into northern Eastern Europe and then moved west. And so if you look at, this is the issue. Let's look at the geology, the geography of these regions and the mountain ranges. So what separated Italy and southern Europe from northern Europe for all of those centuries, thousands of years? And the Israelites had moved north into basically Ireland, England, northern Spain a little bit, very small contingency there who eventually moved into Ireland, and then into the Scandinavian, what are now the Scandinavian countries, in northern Germany. And these were totally, totally isolated from southern Europe. And then look at Spain. Spain was basically controlled by Moors, very advanced civilization, high culture, music, art, etc., architecture, etc. But they came from northern Africa. And now what prevented them from making it up to the into the British Isles and Ireland, etc., was the mountain range known as the Pyrenees. So that held them into Spain. That held the Moors, etc., in Spain, and they did not advance farther into northern Europe. Okay, and that was also something that throughout history kept Spain separate from the other European countries, from France, from Italy, etc., and Germany, and that was throughout history. The Pyrenees are just a tremendously difficult set of mountains to cross. The first inkling of communication then between old Rome and England was when Rome was developing, and this is around the time of Christ, with the need for metal. And this is such an important point that I pointed out in that March 4th lecture when I talked about Joseph of Arimathea. He was an Israelite. He's the minister of mines in Rome. Now, why would the Romans choose or have, they didn't choose, it was the way it was, why would the Romans have a minister of mines who was an Israelite, who was blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy in the midst of Rome, where everybody has, you know, the Italians, there's not a lot of people with blue eyes in Italy. Let me just tell you that. But why would they have an Israelite, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy that's their minister of mines? And that is because the metals came from England, which was controlled by the Celts at that time, the Israelites. And that's why it is so very important to understand who this guy was. And he was Mary's uncle. And I made the point that she was not some waif child off in the middle of the dirt bowl someplace. She came from a very wealthy family. And Joseph of Arimathea was probably one of the richest people in all of Rome. And he had the contacts in England, primarily around what's now known as Glastonbury, where the mining took place and then the shipping to bring it back across and then get it packed up and traveled over to Rome. But see, the Romans couldn't go there. The Romans, with all their might, with everything, the Roman legions and everything else, they could not go to England because they would get the crap beat out of them by the Celts. The Romans feared the Celts in all of their dealings, etc. And when they finally got through the Black Forest, which is another physical barrier between Rome and Italy and Southern Europe and Northern Europe, when they finally got through there, once again, they got the crap beat out of them by the Northern German people who were Israelites. Okay, so at any rate, I wanted to point this out. Now, let's get to the listener's question. This woman wrote in and she said, are the Rothschilds therefore, because they're German, are the Rothschilds Israelites? This is why I'm glad people write in these questions, because if this person's thinking this, then a lot of other people are thinking it also, or thinking something similar. No, the Rothschilds are not Israelites. The Rothschilds are descendants, if you go back far enough in history, of Baal. And I'm not going to talk a lot about that on this show. It's a complicated situation. But that part of the Black Forest at the time was controlled. Now, remember the Grimm Brothers fairy tales? And a lot of them aren't really fairy tales. They're pretty gruesome. Dealing with pedophilia, dealing with eating kids. And I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit graphic here. That's why I don't want to go into a lot of detail. But no, the Rothschilds are not, I repeat, they are not Israelites. They descended from another crew of people and that have nothing to do with Israelites. And they came into prominence in the terms of the modern sense, when the Vatican started controlling Europe and England, primarily also England, once remember that the Roman army marched in and got all the way to Glastonbury for the first time. It took them 300 years after the death of Christ to do that. And they destroyed the monastery and the library of Joseph of Arimathea, and that was overpower. Remember, they killed Christ because he was taking away their power. And the threat that the Joseph of Arimathea library had for the people who are then taking control, basically, of the world, are the same groups that are controlling it now, and they have evolved quite a bit during the subsequent 1700 years to where we get up to today, approximate 1700 years. But the point is that no, the Rothschilds were not Israelites. They were descendants of Baal, and Baal was the devil worshiper from a long, long time ago. That's a complicated story. But during the Middle Ages, and I've talked about this, where after the discovery of the Americas by Columbus, there was just a mad rush to build ships, to loot, and it was immediate. I mean, 1492 is the end of the century, and Columbus went right back. The word got out, everybody else started going there, and within 20 years, literally, the shipping started, the raiding and pillaging of especially the Aztecs, And the Incas, they were the ones with the loot, with the gold, with the incredible, absolutely incredible amounts of gold. When I was visiting Cusco a number of years ago, there's a cathedral there, and most of the cathedrals that were built by the Spanish were, they took the stone from the Inca monuments and buildings, cut them down to build the Catholic churches that dot Cusco and Peru, but the especially Cusco. But they left some, and there's a wall there. The wall is maybe 4 meters thick, so maybe 10 feet thick, big stone walls. And it was capped all the way around. This is where the imperial empire of the Incas was when the Spanish showed up. And it was capped all the way around with a big dome of solid gold. I mean, massive, massive, massive amounts of gold. And the Spanish took this, and the only way they could move it easily was to melt it down and put it into ingots. And that's where the term pieces of eight came. Remember the old pirates, stealing pieces of eight? The pieces of eight were a gold coin, and it had a cross on each side, signifying Christ. I'm sure Christ would not have approved of what the Spanish did. But anyway, then the name of Christ, they put a cross on both sides of the coin, and therefore the term pieces of eight. And so they filled the belly of these massive ships, hundreds of ships, making dozens of passages back and forth between the New World and Spain and England, etc. And all of this wealth, this fabulous, even by today's standards, fabulous amount of wealth, made its way to the Vatican, because they controlled at the time England, Spain, Italy, Venice, all of the merchants that were buying for Portugal, etc., all of the merchants that were buying for wealth out of the New World, all of that came back to the Vatican. And so the Vatican got a shot in the arm, so to speak, financially, and the Rothschilds became the banking entity. Now, the Israelites, speaking of banking, did not allow usury. So the banking system that's in place today is not an Israelite entity. It's not something that they would do, nor did they ever do in history. It was specifically forbidden. And that's why it was such a shock when the Colburn came to surface. And I was one of the first three people to get a copy. And but in there specifically talks about the way to live, etc. And so the whole issue of usury and banking, the way it is put together today, the Rothschilds, the head of the World Bank, with the CIA in the United States, their police force, that is not an Israelite entity at all. In fact, that is the conflict. That's the conflict that's going on today as the people, as the Rothschilds who organized the creation of Israel after World War II, create that entire place. And so I'm not going to go into a lot of that history, but there's the name Israel was from that region, but the people who went there had no history there at all. They were not Israelites. So therein lies a lot of the confusion that's going on today. And it's the Vatican Jesuit-operated bank, and the people that you never see their names, never see their faces, that are basically controlling the United States government, the government of England, the European Economic Union. They were controlling Russia up to a point, and where Putin just basically threw them out, moved off of the petrodollar, started trading off of that, and organized the Orthodox Church of Russia as the state official religion. So it's like the, what we thought of in the 50s as the United States Christian, good, God on our side, it's totally reversed now. United States now is run by demonic Satan worshipers in Russia is has the purest form of the Christian religion on the planet. Don't say that to people from Greece, however. They will not agree with you on that because of the Eastern Orthodox Church. They have maintained the purity of Christianity down through the ages. But at any rate, the Catholic Church has been completely taken over by Jesuits. And who are the Jesuits? They were a group of people who were converted in Spain during the Middle Ages, during the Inquisition, to Catholicism. They went underground, and they eventually took over the Catholic Church. And that all happened about the same time that Columbus discovered the New World and all that wealth came in, and that's been propagated ever since. Okay, so that might fill in a little bit, and those are very good questions, that because it's essential to understand who these groups of people are. Now, I would just cap it off by summarizing what I said on March 4th, that when the United States opened up, and this is back in the, you know, the from the very original pilgrims that came over, the settlers, and formed the first colonies, etc. They were under religious persecution in wherever they came from. And they, by the way, were not very fond of Catholics. as a few people have pointed out, and historically that's correct. But the Israelites from Ireland, from England, from the northern European countries, the Germans, the northern Germans, etc., came in mass to the United States. And with the tremendous resources of the United States, developed basically the United States, the tremendous country from sea to shining sea, so to speak, based on the great resources. And of course, we got dragged into two world wars, which were banker wars, that we should have never been fought in the first place. And guess what? You had Israelites fighting Israelites. You had the Germans, and you know, and that's a complex history in itself. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but the banker wars, the United States has been fighting banker wars for, you know, a couple hundred years now. It was the War of 1812. By 1812, you know, the United States was forming in like 1776 to 1778, somewhere in that time frame, Declaration of Independence, the new Congress, the Constitutional Convention, etc. It was just, 30 years later, 35 years later, when the European bankers got back into the U.S. And they really had a hand in forming the original. You had Hamilton and the other bankers who wanted the European style of banking in the United States so they could make money. They saw it as, you know, and the other opposing force was the Declaration of Independence, which said that you can't tax people. You cannot put a tax on the hard work of people. You get to work and keep what you earn, and the government cannot tax you. And that was the entire point of the United States. And now look at where it is. Absolutely insane, taxing the air you breathe and literally gas that might come out of you too pretty soon. Anyway, but what's happened here is that the Jesuit-controlled Vatican and the Rothschild banking community, which are the descendants of Baal, have taken over the planet. Okay? I'll just leave it there. You can think about that, but that's the way it is. Okay. Well, I'm sure that topic will continue into the future. Now, this is something that really struck me, and this just came out. This was on space.com the other day, and I always go there. I don't go there to learn science. I learn to see what bogus crap they're trying to pawn off on you, the public. But anyway, space.com wrote passed this article dealing with Hale-Bopp. Actually, the article was about a new comet that they say is the most pristine comet, you know, just a bunch of garbage, not worth repeating. In fact, I don't talk a lot about things going on in space and in astronomy today, because everything I see is just garbage and it's not worth even repeating on the air. But this article was talking about a comet that is recently being observed by astronomers. It's telescope visible. But they were comparing it to Hale-Bopp. And then they had a picture of Hale-Bopp that was taken in September 18th, 2012. And I'm looking at the date and I'm going, wait a minute. And this is from the International Space Station by a camera, like a regular camera, because you can see you can see the Earth, the curvature of the Earth. And so that means this was taken by not with a telescope or any type of advanced optics. It was just a regular camera or maybe somebody's telephone. Who knows? But there was Hale-Bopp up above the crescent of the Earth and fully blown comet. But now, wait a minute. September 18, 2012, that's like less than 10 years ago. Hale-Bopp at that time was way out of the solar system, well beyond Pluto. And so I'm going, wait a minute. And so, I mean, I had to read this about two or three times. So I went to the orbit of Hale-Bopp. Am I missing something here? Is there something going on that I'm not aware of? Did Hale-Bopp all of a sudden come back into the solar system or something? No, Hale-Bopp crossed out of the solar system, back in the 2000s, early 2000s, because I remember it happening. But here they have a picture, September 18, 2012, that's like, and Hale-Bopp was way beyond Pluto, probably many times the distance of Pluto to the sun. And here it is being taken with a camera, just a regular camera, and it's big. It's big. I mean, a full-blown comet. And wait a minute. Comets are only supposed to exist in the inner solar system or out to Jupiter. And if you see one beyond Saturn, the two biggest comets in history were discovered beyond Saturn. There's one K2 coming in now that was discovered way out there. It might hold the record. And Hale-Bopp was literally the comet most distant discovered, although they don't announce that. It was literally discovered in 1991. The official discovery of Hale-Bopp was in July of 1995, but NASA had already seen it and under contract with the Naval Observatory had records going back into the 80s, in fact, of visible pictures of Hale-Bopp once they started looking. But it was in 1991 where Robert Harrington finally confirmed the orbit, and I'm certain that he also discovered the companion at that time. And that's when things went underground. That's when NASA went underground. That's when Dan Golden came in, took over NASA, put the lid on them. This was when George Bush Sr. was turning over the baton, the presidential baton, to his long-term drug buddy, Billy Clinton. And Dan Golden came in from the CIA to put the lid on NASA. That was 1991. So there's a lot of hocus pocus going on around this comet Hale-Bopp. But anyway, this blew my mind, and I had to go back and read it again. But this was a NASA photo issued and taken from the International Space Station in 2012 of the comet Hale-Bopp, which was way out of the solar system. What's wrong with this picture? Very bizarre. Very, very bizarre. That's all I can tell you. And I have screen captured all of this. This is comparable to back in the day. There was this ongoing kind of verbal fight between NASA and people that were sincerely asking NASA to make some kind of proof that the Apollo landings took place. And so at this time, 1986, so we have this wonderful Hubble Space Telescope up in space, and we can look at, anything up there. And so the cry went out, why don't you turn the Hubble Space Telescope towards the moon, the lunar surface, and with your great optics that we all paid for as taxpayers, take a picture of the Apollo landing sites. And, of course, this is before anybody had the ability to get back to the moon or anything like that. And so NASA came out, you know, they had to scratch their head a little, some other body parts, and try and figure out a response because they didn't want to have the Hubble Space Telescope taking pictures of the alleged Apollo lunar landing sites. Okay, so anyway, they came out and said, oh no, the lunar surface is much too bright. We cannot train the Hubble Space Telescope on the moon. About 2 weeks later, some inventive young new astronomer got some Hubble Space Telescope time and turned the Hubble Space Telescope to the moon and took a picture of the whole moon, the entire moon, which has all of the light coming from the entire moon. I mean, a full moon, basically, with no atmospheric aberration, no atmospheric attenuation at all. Takes a picture of the entire full moon and publishes on the internet. This is after NASA says, we can't take a picture of this little teeny-weeny patch of the lunar surface because it's too bright. This guy takes a picture of the whole moon. Anyway, it's another absurdity. And when these absurdities come out, I like to point it out. There's one other absurdity that I noticed this week, and one of my, I would say, enemies at NASA is a guy named Tony Phillips. The guy is a jerk. He's the guy that filters all of NASA's information before it gets to you, the public. His job is to make sure that you get garbage science. That's Tony Phillips' job. He's the joker that when I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting making presentations, he would take my poster session printed 8.5 by 11 sheets that were in the news media room, he would take them and throw them in the garbage. Yeah, that's Tony. Real honest guy. Still working for NASA, still covering up. So anyway, this week on spaceweather.com, Tony is noted as saying that back in the, this is in 2001, there was a pretty good solar flare. And, of course, that was during the end of the Hale-Bopp era, and we had all of this solar activity back in the Hale-Bopp era. And I was constantly talking about that. I had my other webpage, the Millennium Group webpage, which had millions of hits continually during that era. And, of course, NASA denied that there was anything to that. And, of course, the reason that the sun was very active for that entire Hale-Bopp period was because Hale-Bopp was discharging the solar capacitor. And there were like 3-4 X-class flares per day coming out of the sun. And so the observation was that down in Phoenix, where apparently Tony hangs out, had auroras all the way down there and even as far into as Mexico. They were seeing auroras in the sky because of this tremendous solar flare activity. Okay, so anyway, this past week, there was no solar activity at all, not even a sunspot. And so we're supposedly heading into the next solar cycle, but nothing's going on. They want to make news where there isn't any. But the point is that they have to mention that, you know, I guess the point is that they did not know what was causing that tremendous flaring activity back then. And because Hale-Bopp discharged the solar capacitor to such a level over about an 8-year period, then the sun went quiet because it's part of that electrical cycle that keeps the sun fueled with hydrogen and very active. That's that electrical current of outmoving excess current of protons in a solar wind and the return current sheets, and then also the sun bringing in hydrogen as ongoing fuel because the fusion is up in the atmosphere of the sun. So at any rate, it's just another case of NASA having no clue what's going on out there. I've got a few minutes left here. yesterday I was on John Moore's show, and Tim Spencer was the host guest. And so I was, you know, my regular weekly guest appearance there. And Tim introduced me. He said, he's the smartest man I ever know. And I thought, well, Tim, you know, I said, well, who did you know to compare this to? He goes, everybody at NASA. He lived in Cocoa Beach as he grew up there. His dad was the commissioner of police. And so all of the people there, all the physicists, all the scientists, the rocket scientists, including Wernher von Braun, knew Tim, and he knew them. And so anyway, it was kind of a surprise that somebody would say that, but that it's not the first time that that's happened. I've been on the show with James Fetzer, Professor Emeritus, University of Minnesota. Robert David Steele said the same thing. And I was on George Norrie's show one night when a listener called in and went through about a five-minute litany about the value that I present as a national treasure. So I'm just repeating this. This is what people have said. And so anyway, I just wanted to make a comment. I, you know, work very hard at what I do, and those are very big compliments. And I'm very aware of the work I've done and the excellent, you know, how this is groundbreaking work in so many different directions. But I just want to tell you, and this is for students out there, that you have to be very honest, hardworking. You have to think outside the box, and you have to be able to communicate with your own spirit. And I also suggest that people spend a lot of time alone. And if you look at any of the prophets, for example, not that I'm a prophet, but they all spent time alone, 40 days and 40 nights in the desert alone. And if you have that type of time, well, I did this when I was a kid. I would go canoeing for 2-3 months by myself, or go up into the woods or into the wilderness, or going out walking. And it's that's the time you start communicating with your inner spirit. And it's very important, because that's where you get a handle on yourself. And it's kind of scary at first. Let me tell you, the first time I went out by myself, and I was up, and it was like I was waiting for the bears and the wolves to come out of the woods and eat me alive. But after a while, you start getting a confidence also that's very important. And when you study physics, for example, you have to not just answer the questions in the book. Anybody can do that, anybody that's good at math. But you have to become honest with yourself. And that's the biggest thing that I see amongst people who are textbook geniuses, but the really bad scientists and engineers. Anyway, I'll leave it at that, because I'm out of time. I'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.